Blog Talk Radio.
Transformation Zone. I'm your host, Velton Shaw, and I am here, and I am supercharged today and ready to go, because I know, if you haven't realized yet, that today is the first day of the rest of our lives, and we have to do everything possible to be the best that we can be. And tonight, we're going to work on being the best that we can be by taking our performance from good to great. Good evening. I am really supercharged and glad that you're here tonight. I don't know if you can tell by my voice, but I am locked, loaded, and ready to go, because I have a guest tonight. It's a gentleman that I've known, well, I'm going to tell my age now, and Darrell, excuse me, for telling our age.
That's okay, because we look good. We look like we're in our 40s.
I've known this gentleman for over 35 years. Did you hear that? 35 years. Can you believe that? But I'm going to tell you, we reconnected a couple of months ago, and we're working in a similar space. I'll let him tell you a little bit more about himself and what he does, but he's up in the northeast in New Jersey, which is where I'm originally from. And he's in the East Orange area and affiliated with one of the universities up there called Seton Hall. And he has a company that is called the Gunter Group, and they specialize in digital media and socialization. And his name is Darrell Gunter. And I'm really excited to have him as my guest tonight. Darrell, how are you, my friend?
Velton, I am doing awesome. It's so great to reconnect with you and be on the Transformation Zone. I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight.
Well, you know, I'm excited to have you here. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, Darrell had me on his show a couple of weeks ago, and we had a supercharged time. We had a great time. We talked about leadership from my perspective and what I try to relay to my audiences and my network from a leadership standpoint. And the great thing about it is, because we're in the same space, I can now flip the script and I can be the student and listen from Darrell's perspective of his thoughts and philosophies on leadership. And I want to just, before we get into it, Darrell, can you tell the audience just a little bit about your background, where you came from, and what you do?
Oh, absolutely. It's such a pleasure to do that. Born and raised in Atlantic City, attended Seton Hall University, where I was in the Stillman School of Business, and graduated with my Bachelor of Science in Business Administration with a concentration in marketing. From there, I went to work for Xerox, selling copiers, actually door-to-door in the business products division back in the early 80s. Did that successfully for 2 years. And before I left, I was ranked number 20 in the nation among new business reps for Xerox. Was recruited over to Dow Jones Financial News Services, and was very excited to make that move, because it opened up my eyes to the digital world back in the 80s. As a matter of fact, I was one of the first salespeople for Dow Jones News Retrieval, which is now called Factiva, in Los Angeles in 83. Had a great career at Dow Jones, worked my way up around the company and the country, moved from New York to L.A., promoted to Chicago, and then came back to New York as the national sales director. Had three very successful years. Then was recruited over to a company called Elsevier, which is the world's largest scholarly publisher. And they needed someone to build their first commercial sales organization. and for the Americas. And they were going to hire 4 managing directors around the world. And I was blessed to be provided that opportunity. But it gave me the opportunity to utilize all of the skills that I learned, not only at Seton Hall, but at Xerox and Dow Jones. And also, while I was in Chicago, I stopped off the way at Lake Forest Graduate School of Management, got my executive MBA, and built Elsevier's most successful sales customer service marketing organization, built it up to 130 full-time employees, and we grew the business from $285 million to $385 million in my region over the next 11 years. We led sales globally and got the entrepreneurial itch and decided to leave my corner office in Park Avenue South in New York and go to a small company in Columbia, South Carolina as their executive vice president, chief marketing officer. The company was called Calexis, and it's a semantic analytics company, which people recognize as the big data analytics. And as the EVP CMO, I was able to put in a business strategy that grew the revenues from $400,000 in 2007 to $6 million in 3 years. Coincidentally, then positioned the company to be acquired by my former company, Elsevier. And sold the company, did an executive transition. Then I went to work for the American Institute of Physics as their chief commercial officer, but then decided that I really wanted to start my own company. And Gunter Media Group was formed in August of 2011. And since that time, we have been working with executives on their strategy. I simply like to say that, you know, we are an executive management consulting firm, and we're bespoke, where we understand what the company's issues are, and we put forth a strategy and implement a strategy to help them deal with the problems. And we've been in business, this is our 6th year, and we have a number of clients around the globe, Croatia, China, Japan, the United Kingdom. So we're very blessed, but also always looking for that next opportunity where we can be of service to our clients.
Absolutely. Wow. An incredible track record, to say the least. And I'm honored to have you on the show tonight, primarily because of our friendship, but also because of your expertise in not only helping other people, but leading dynamic organizations, sales organizations, management organizations throughout your career. One of the questions that I have for you, Darrell, as you started to explain your experience, where you come from, what you've done, is we all talk about leadership. We all have past mentors and people that we've aspired to be like, and philosophies of what we feel though leadership is really all about. But can you tell the audience just a little bit about, from your perspective, what makes a great leader?
You know, I've learned, my mother was my first mentor. We had a grocery store in Atlantic City. And there's many attributes to a great leader. One of the traits that I feel is that a leader has got to be knowledgeable. A leader does not need to know everything, but a leader needs to understand what they know and what they don't know so that they can give proper information while they're leading. The other thing, I think, dealing with today's knowledge workers, I think leaders have to have a very high emotional intelligence score, meaning that they really need to manage to the individual and not to the situation where it's my way or the highway. And knowledge workers need to be given the leeway to be able to get the job done, as long as it's clear in regard to what their objective is, what's the timeline, and that the goal is achievable. A leader needs to allow the knowledge worker to do their work and get out of the way. And it is about putting the best people in the best possible position. A leader understands everyone's strengths and weaknesses, and they look beyond whatever their personal feelings are. The worst thing that you can do to one of your colleagues is to put them in a position that they're not equipped to handle. Typically, you'll find that people always want to do the right thing. However, if they don't have the skill set or the knowledge to do a particular skill that they're required to do, they're going to do the best that they can. And unfortunately, when there's not a good match, it's not going to work out well.
Wow. So, you know, it's interesting because as I was listening to what you were talking about, it kind of hit home in a couple of the philosophies that even I share with people about leadership. And, you know, I heard ringing loud and clear the focus on being a visionary versus a person who develops a task list of things that have to be done in sequential order. One of my favorite people was Steve Jobs, and he said, "We hire brilliant people not to tell them what to do, but for them to tell us what to do." Can you talk a little bit about, from a leadership philosophy standpoint, about giving people that levity, that space, that room to be able to be creative and to be to think outside the box and challenge the status quo?
You know, well, there's a few things that you have there in regard to allowing folks to think out of the box. And you and I are both a big fans of Tim Collins. And he also wrote a book called Before Good to Great. I'm trying to remember the title of the book, Built to Last. And in there, you'll find companies that have allowed employees to take 25% of their time to work on different projects, which is great. But to the point of the task at hand, because keep in mind that you're running a business, and you have track A is running the everyday business. Track B could be doing something innovative. For the track A, you always want to have what I feel is that check and balance. My brother Gaffney Gunter, who is now retired from running a very successful group of McDonald's restaurants that he's had, one of the key things that he's always said is to inspect what you expect. Too often times, if you allow someone too much leeway and their personality is not cut for that, then you're going to find that they're probably not going to hit their milestones. So it's always good to have those checks and balances. As you know, in accounting, there's all these checks and balances. And it's the same thing in business. They have checkpoints. And those checkpoints with the milestones allow us to see where we are and then to ask questions, because everything is not going to go as smoothly as we want, because that's the way that life is. But the question is what type of questions are we asking our team members about why they did not hit the number or finish the product? You know, what did we learn from that? Because there's no such thing as failure. There's experience to be gained. Because whatever the experience was that you did not achieve your goal, you still learned something very, very valuable. And you want to use that in the most constructive way.
Let me ask you this. As a leader or a manager, how do you create a culture that encourages people to do these things, to go the extra mile, to strive for perfection or greatness or high levels of of performance?
You know, Velton, it starts with the vision of the company, and then, of course, with the mission. And then it reverts down to developing the strategy, with the objectives and the tactics that's going to get there. And also, what type of reporting systems do you have and what type of reward systems do you have? But even before then, it's the onboarding process of having the right people, people who genuinely want to help the company to achieve its objective and believe in it. But also, the leaders have got to convey that position as well. The leaders in the company, when I say leaders, there's not just one leader in a company. There are leaders. But it all starts with the CEO and the CEO's lieutenant. Because if everyone is demonstrating the best practices, then those are going to be the practices that are going to be practiced throughout the organization. As soon as you have someone come in and do something that is not consistent with those values, it has to be dealt with. Give you a case in point. When I was building the Elsevier organization from the ground up, I started with 18 people, and I just hired a slew of people. And unfortunately, it just the way it happened, most of them were men. And there was a couple of women that were hired. And I was walking into, we were having a meeting, and they were waiting for me, and I was walking into the conference room, and I thought I heard something inappropriate, like locker room talk, so to speak. And I could tell one of the young ladies was uncomfortable. And I asked, okay, what's going on? And the person who was the, it's a shame, it's the oldest person in there who is misbehaving. And he said, oh, I didn't mean anything. I was just joking. And I just said, right now, this is a great time for us to learn something, that this is not a locker room. This is not a men's club. We respect all people, men, women, all nationalities. So I want everyone to understand that right now. It never happened again. But had I allowed that to go on, who knows what would have occurred down the line. So the leader has to demonstrate, and they have to walk the walk, you know, they talk the talk and walk the walk. You have to demonstrate that. And then also, how do you deal with poor performance? Poor performance needs to be dealt with right away. Phil Jackson, in his book Hoop Dreams, he talks about take 10 minutes. Don't wait till next week. Don't wait to tomorrow. Take 10 minutes right now to discuss the situation, and discuss the situation in a professional manner, and ask the individual how do they feel about their performance. What do they feel that they could have done better? What would they do differently? If the individual steps up to the plate and says, you know what, thinking about it, I could have done this better, I could have done that better, and next time, this is how I'm going to do it. So the individual takes that responsibility right away, and you deal with that. Because you have to look at, when you're dealing with knowledge workers or any employee, you have to look at the skill versus will. Do they have the skill to do it, and do they have the will to do it? You will find that sometimes people have the skill, but they don't have the will. And the will is they don't have the right attitude. They're negative, and that has to be dealt with. If they don't have the skill, the question is, can you train them? Do they have the aptitude for that? And if they do, give them the training. If they don't, try to find them a spot where they do have a good match and fit.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, it's amazing because as I sit and I listen to you, we're both big Phil Jackson fans, and we're talking about culture for those of you who have just joined us. And one of the things that I love about Phil and his philosophy about culture, he said, good teams become great when the players trust each other enough to replace me with we. And based on what you're just talking about, creating that kind of a culture and environment where people understand what their strengths are and what their areas of opportunity are, and they're willing to share both without fear, so that the team itself can become a better team than when they were when they started.
And let me give you an example. And sometimes you got to take decisions that are not popular. One year, it was December, it was at Elsevier, we had already hit our budget. We had already hit our sales budget, and we knew that our next year's sales budget was going to be high. So the sales team was told, you know, if you can make additional money this year by putting in your orders, do that. But if you're already at a place on the plan where it's not going to make a difference, why don't you hold it till January 1? But one young man who had started with us as a sales support person, then he became an associate account manager, and then he became an account manager. And I asked him to cover a territory for me, which was Texas, because the salesperson had moved on and we had an open territory. And one of the big deals that we were working on had just closed, and it was like December 27th. So my financial guy says, Darrell, we really should hold this over because, you know, this will help us get off to a good start. But then I said, you know what, but the young man was working on this. He put a lot of time and effort into this. And he will make a good bonus if he puts it in. If he puts it in January 1, you know, it starts over again. So I made the decision to allow him to put the order in now.
Mm-hmm.
And the sales team, when they saw and heard about that decision, I tell you, I could have ran for president and won, because they said, this is the type of manager who looks out for his, you know, for his team. And that young man is now a global sales director for Elsevier. And I see him from time to time. You know, so it's so important that, you know, there's King Solomon decisions that need to be made. And it's all about being fair and being firm and fair and being consistent.
Absolutely. You know, and it's a motivational thing for the staff for leadership to understand just the details, the minor details of the individual's needs, but also within the scope of what the team needs. So that's incredible. I'm glad to hear that we're able to do that. One of the things that you know, is a big topic right now, and I know you and I have kind of touched on it previously in our conversations, but I want you to speak a little bit on this. I read a book a couple of years ago by Travis Bradbury and Gene Graves, and it's called Emotional Intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about your view of emotional intelligence and why you feel it's important in today's environment from a leadership perspective, but also from a team participatory perspective.
You know, I am a huge fan of emotional intelligence. I have a presentation that I do, that I lecture on, called How to Build High-Performing Teams. And for a CEO to understand and embrace emotional intelligence is very important. Emotional intelligence, first of all, it's understanding who you are, understanding your SWOT analysis, understanding what type of personality type that you are, but also understanding the personality types of other people and understanding what their SWOT analysis is on each of those personality types. So that when they're talking to you, like someone who is a driver, of knowing how to position what they want and where they want to go in a very productive way. Someone who is an analytical, understanding how they need to receive information, how they need to give information. So with the emotional intelligence, it's really being able to adapt who you are, and not losing who you are, but adapting your management style to the individual to get the best out of them. I'll give you an example. When I launched that Elsevier team, I had a lot of young drivers. All they wanted to do was sell. They didn't want to do paperwork, and they wanted to come in late because they work late. And I said to one gentleman, who we're dear friends today, Kieran Anderson. He runs his father's publishing house. He was coming in late on a regular basis. and I knew about his commute because I had the same commute. And if you miss one train, it's going to delay you. But I said to him, I said, why should I have to take your phone call? Because you're not here. And he said, you know, Darrell, you're right. You shouldn't have to take my phone calls because I'm not here. I'm going to be here. So it's really understanding how do you motivate the individual in a very positive and constructive way versus management style of old was it's my way or the highway and very ego-centered driven. And at Seton Hall, one of the things I love about Seton Hall where I teach with my colleague, professional selling with John Hoffman, is that Seton Hall is about servant leadership. Because when you're there to serve as a leader, that means that you're taking time to understand all of the nuances of the people that you're managing. You know, my mother, I'm the youngest of seven, and she treats us all very, very special in a different way. We all have a different relationship with her. They're all good relationships, but it's just different. So, again, emotional intelligence is about understanding who you are, understanding your strengths and weaknesses. What are the things that might flip your switch and get you a little upset? You have to learn how to manage that. And how do you apply your management style to all the different personalities within your group? But the common thread is that people see that you're firm, you're fair, and you're consistent.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Amazing. Fantastic. Well, you know, it's interesting. We speak and we talk, we lecture, we tell people, and we leave people with information. And a lot of times, once they leave our presence, they remember what we tell them over a limited period of time. But one of the things that I've learned, you and I are both avid readers, is that when you find things and you read and you continue to prime the pump or continue to load your arsenal with information, it becomes part of who you are. Can you recommend any periodicals, books, or information for people to read to be able to continue to enrich their lives, enrich their leadership skills, and enhance their ability to perform?
You know, I always like to start with books that allow you to self-identify who you are. There's a book called What Color's My Parachute? Has been around for decades. The gentleman is actually still alive, and he updates it every year. It helps you to understand your personality. There's another book, which is a classic, which is I'm Okay, You're Okay. My sister actually mm-hmm. had me read that when I was in the fifth grade. It talks about the, you know, how people take on parent, adult, child behaviors. I think that there's a topic that I've been diving into lately, your ideal self, or might be translated to your authentic self. And this is a topic that I'm going to be blogging about because it's very exciting, because this talks about how do you become your ideal self. But the most important point about being your ideal self is that it's not a destination. It's a journey. And only way to do that is to understand where you are currently and what are the areas. What is your SWOT analysis? What are the areas that you want to improve? And then set out a plan of action to work on those things where you feel you want to improve. And to not try, you will not do it in 1 week. You will not do it. Change is hard. Change takes time. And you have to do something every day. Just a little bit. If you do just a little bit every day, or whatever that activity is, you will improve. The other thing that I want to stress, that my colleague John Hoffman and I stress, is that in making change is very hard. And the way to make change stick is to learn what is the best practice. Number two, to practice the best practice. Number three, to get feedback from someone you trust. And to do that on a regular basis, whatever that practice is. My wife, Deb, always says, if you want to change something in your life, do it 21 days straight. You will probably affect that change.
There you go. Great. You know what, my friend, believe it or not, we are out of time. And I want to just say this. I have thoroughly enjoyed our time together this evening, and I need you to make me a promise that before the end of 2017, you'll come back and we can continue this conversation.
Oh, you can count on it. And I want to have you back on my program, Leadership, as well.
You know, I'm just a phone call away, and I will be more than happy to come back and speak to your audience. Thanks again, my friend.
Beautiful.
We've had the opportunity to spend just 30 minutes with one of my friends, and you can see why. After 35 years of not speaking, the connection was magical, because when you have people in your network or people that you come in contact with that are like, have like minds, like aspirations, like goals, and just a passion for life, even though you're not together every day, the friendship never fails. The leadership that we talk about today will always be there because you lead as a group and a network, and you lead each other to excellence. Again, I want to thank you very much for your time and your devotion to speaking or to being with us every week. We'll be back next Thursday with another phenomenal guest. And until then, remember, transform your thinking. You will transform your world. I'm your host, Felton Shaw. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. God bless and good night.